XE KBXE.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Protesters clashed with federal agents in Chicago yesterday after U.S. Border Patrol shot a woman in a car. We'll have the latest. And a record-setting drought in Massachusetts means water restrictions. We talked to a meteorologist who says it may be a while before wet weather returns. Plus, up in the air at a hot air balloon fest in Albuquerque.
Looking in the sky is like watching a Jackson Pollock painting. These balloons are everywhere and just splashes of color. You can't take it in.
It's Sunday, October 5th. News is next.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with a special edition of the Up North Report. Suicide is a grim subject across all backgrounds, but its risks are keenly felt in Indigenous communities. The statistics are equally grim. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that in 2022, the second leading cause of death for Native youths was suicide, and the overall death rate from suicide for American Indians and Alaska Natives was 91% higher than the total population. While prevalent, Bemidji State Professor Mark Bays says it's a difficult subject to talk about in Indigenous communities.
It's a very, very sensitive topic, and a lot of our people do not want to bring up something such as suicide, because we may believe that as soon as we bring the spirit about a death, then we bring it around our people and our community. So it's taboo to be speaking about death.
Bays is a member of the Tapalang Kawali Tekan Tribe's Waterbird Clan, sharing geography with Texas and of Mohawk and Pawnee descent. He has practiced psychology and related fields for more than 15 years across Indian country and has published numerous articles. He says it was imperative to develop a screening tool that addresses the unique factors for suicide risk of Indigenous people.
It's important that we understand where we came and where we overcame and being resilient, but it's also just as important that we talk about generational healing. That we don't just talk about historical trauma, intergenerational trauma, and say, thank y'all for coming and leave.
But developing screening questions that set it apart from westernized assessments was no easy task. After consulting with Indigenous peers in his field, he says he went old school for further research.
I needed to go into ceremony saying, Creator, we need to do something about our lives for those that continue to choose to take their life and how we can honor who they are and provide support and motivation and strategies to keep them alive and honor their spirit while they are alive.
Bay says the elders he consulted with agreed that something needed to be done and helped guide him toward the how.
We need to do it in a way that we do not, one, bring up that spirit. And to me, that's, as a psychologist, it's don't re-traumatize. Every time we ask, hey, you want to kill yourself? We're bringing that spirit back up. We have to change the language. This instrument that you want to create, it needs to be culturally responsive.
He says he spent several months developing the screening questions, ensuring they were culturally relevant while consulting with Indigenous practitioners until the elders gave him more advice.
They were saying you need to incorporate allies. And I was a little hesitant because I'm like, this is why we're in a predicament that we are, is because we have a lot of non-Native individuals that may not truly understand our way. So instead of providing that word or that question that should be presented, they may not ask it because I'm not Native and maybe I don't want to offend them. So let me just kind of bypass that. But the elders were saying the majority practitioners across the United States that are administering suicide screening tools are non-Native.
Consulting with non-Native mental health workers with multiple years of experience of working in Indian country helped fine-tune what's called the Indigenous Suicide Assessing Factors of Event Screening Tool, which is about to start its pilot study with tribal agencies neighboring Bemidji.
We want to make sure that it is able to identify risk factors for suicide in addition to being able to recognize and identify protective factors.
After the initial study, Bay says the next step is a larger pilot study including tribes across the United States. Bays, in addition to his research and his role as assistant professor at Bemidji State, also co-directs the Indigenous Studies in the Psychology program at BSU and serves as president of the Society of Indian Psychologists. If you or a loved one has thoughts of suicide, help is available from the 988 Lifeline. It's a free, confidential mental health hotline that connects people with counselors 24/7 on matters beyond suicidal thoughts, such as economic worries, substance use disorder, intimate partner violence, and more. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Weekend edition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Tensions erupted into violence at a Chicago protest over the weekend after federal agents shot and wounded a woman. The Department of Homeland Security says the shooting happened after their vehicles were boxed in and rammed by multiple cars. Meanwhile, the governor of Illinois says the Trump administration gave him an ultimatum yesterday over the National Guard. Here to tell us more is member station WBEZ's Michael Puente. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Aisha.
So you were at the scene after yesterday's shooting. What do we know about what happened?
Well, this happened on Chicago's southwest side. The Department of Homeland Security on social media said they were out patrolling when cars surrounded and rammed one of their vehicles. They say one of the drivers who rammed that car was armed with a semi-automatic weapon. And they said they were, quote, forced to deploy their weapons and fired defensive shots at an armed U.S. citizen. Now, neither WBEZ or our sister publication, the Chicago Sun-Times, have been able to independently verify that account. Now, the DHS spokesperson said the woman they shot drove herself to the hospital to get care for her wounds. The Chicago Fire Department says she was found on the street and was transported to a hospital.
What was it like in those hours after the shooting?
Tense. Very tense. You know, residents, young, old, women, men came out to protest. Some got in the officers' faces. Federal agents were armed and ready to use tear gas at a moment's notice. And sometimes even when they didn't appear to be provoked, these protests have been happening outside an ICE facility in Broadview, just outside of Chicago, for weeks now. And federal agents have used pepper spray and other crowd control tactics during these demonstrations. So with this latest escalation, residents are worried about where things might go from here.
This is the second shooting in Illinois in recent weeks involving immigration agents. What's the mood like as you walk around?
Aisha, people are angry and they're confused and they're disappointed. And just a few weeks ago, immigration agents shot and killed an immigrant after he allegedly resisted arrest and tried to drive his car into ICE officers. Yesterday at the protest, this is what 20-year-old Trevon House told me.
They're about to start tear gassing us because we're peacefully protesting, but they won't let us exercise our right to peacefully protest. It's just crazy. It's, we're Americans, man. Like, why can't we live in peace, you know?
And right after that, federal agents did tear gas the crowd and people started running. There was also a stunning immigration raid on an apartment building here earlier this week. Witnesses said authorities pulled men, women, and children from their apartments in the middle of the night. Dozens of residents were arrested and some U.S. citizens were detained for hours. The governor is calling for an investigation into this.
Yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker said Trump's Department of War, and those were the words that the governor used, followed up with an ultimatum. Call up your troops or we will. How has Pritzker responded?
Well, Aisha, Pritzker says it's outrageous and un-American. He says what he has said all along, that there is no need for military troops on the ground, and he will not call up the National Guard to further what he calls Trump's acts of aggression against Illinois residents. Pritzker said yesterday morning the Trump administration intends to deploy 300 members of the Illinois National Guard, but so far we haven't seen any troops in Chicago.
That's WBEZ's Michael Puente. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we'll turn to NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram. Good morning, Deepa.
Hey, Aisha. Good morning.
So Chicago is just one of the cities President Trump wants to send the military into, but it is the one that he keeps coming back to over and over again in his comments, even before this weekend's events. Talk to me a little bit about Trump's interest in Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a slow build up to this point because the president has been teasing that he wants to send National Guard members to Chicago for a while now, months and months and months. And about a month ago, he started to escalate that rhetoric and said that the administration was, quote, going into Chicago. But he never specified when exactly that would happen. And then earlier this week, he mentioned the idea again and said it would be happening soon. And he also insulted the state's Democratic governor, J.B. Pritzker, calling him incompetent and stupid. And so that leads us to this weekend. And as you and Michael were just talking about, Pritzker said the Trump administration basically gave him an ultimatum. Either he calls in National Guard members or Trump will supersede him and do it himself. And of course, this all follows up on Trump sending in the National Guard to other cities, right? Like LA and DC. And more recently, he's been trying to send troops to Portland, Oregon, though yesterday a federal judge temporarily blocked Trump's move to send the National Guard to Portland. And I will note that that judge was appointed by Trump in 2019.
Has there been any progress on negotiations to end the federal government shutdown?
Yeah, well, the short answer, Aisha, is no. There doesn't really seem to be an end in sight here. I mean, the Senate failed to move forward on funding proposals on Friday. Senate members are expected to return to the Hill tomorrow to try again. But the House will actually remain out of session per House Speaker Mike Johnson. He said he'd call the House back in session once the Senate can come to an agreement on funding the government. But like I said, there really isn't much agreement going on between the two parties.
Well, on to another set of negotiations. There does seem to be movement in the talks between Israel and Hamas, though, right?
Yes, there has been some updates on the negotiations there. And, you know, just to catch up and put this into context, on Friday, the president posted on social media his platform, Truth Social, and he basically gave Hamas this deadline of 6 p.m. this evening, that's Sunday evening, to accept the ceasefire deal that the White House had put together last week. And that deal was a 20-point plan that had requirements for Hamas to release all the hostages, for Israel to end its war in Gaza, and for aid to immediately come into Gaza. And there were a number of other points as well. And Israel agreed to that deal, but Hamas said that they had lingering questions. But after Trump set that Sunday deadline, Hamas responded a few hours later and accepted the proposal. But that doesn't mean the whole deal is all said and done. There are still some negotiations taking place. And yesterday, for example, Trump posted that Israel had agreed to the withdrawal lines that the White House had drafted in its plan. But the U.S. is still waiting to hear from Hamas on whether they accept that and other elements of the plan as well. So definitely some progress and some movements, but nothing is finalized.
And meanwhile, the president is visiting Norfolk, Virginia. What's bringing him there?
Yeah, Trump is headed out there to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Navy. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth will also be there with the president and the First Lady, Melania Trump. It's planned to be this big celebratory event, though I will note that it is happening during the government shutdown, which means that active duty service members are not getting paid. So I'm pretty curious if the president mentions that in his remarks as this shutdown heads into week number two.
That's NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Deepa, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
To Albuquerque now, where under a desert sky, hundreds of pilots ready themselves to be lighter than air. At dawn, they'll lift off in hot air balloons, painting the October sky in a wash of color. Colorado Public Radio's Haley May shares the view from the Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta.
Ready, go.
On a giant grass launch field, tens of thousands of people from places as far as Mumbai have gathered before sunrise to witness the moment the sky will become a tapestry.
Looking in the sky is like watching a Jackson Pollock painting. These balloons are everywhere and just splashes of color.
Colorado pilot Dave Baer has been flying here since the event began in the 1970s.
And the first balloon fiesta had 13 balloons, and it took off downtown at one of the shopping malls.
This year, his pumpkin-shaped balloon, called Miss Autumn, will take to the skies with 543 others, all in various shapes and colors. 11-year-old Sadie Henricks has some she hopes to check off her list.
I see a teddy bear balloon. I see a lot of colors.
Balloon Fiesta spokesman Tom Garrity says this year's pilots represent 41 states and 12 countries. They're all here to enjoy a weather quirk that's unique to this valley.
What makes Albuquerque really the place that everybody wants to fly is the Albuquerque box.
The winds here form a gentle loop, carrying balloons south near the ground and north a few hundred feet up. It helps keep the balloons gliding safely through the sky because, as Bear says,
how do you steer a balloon? The answer is you don't. You follow the wind wherever it takes you.
First, crews unpack the balloon, setting up the gondola, that's the bit you ride in, and the envelope, the balloon itself. Next, they fill it with cold air using big fans. And finally,
then the third phase is hot inflation, where we actually light the burners and we heat the air inside, and that's what causes the balloon to stand up.
The propane burners shoot orange and blue flames up into the envelope. Stand next to one and you can feel the heat on your skin and see the flush on the pilot's face. But nothing beats the magic of when these house-sized objects suddenly lift off and take to the sky. Garrity with the Fiesta says that's why he thinks people keep coming back.
You know, it's that sense of the unknown. It's a romantic adventure. You get to take to the skies and see where life takes you.
For NPR, I'm Haley May in Albuquerque.
You're listening to NPR News.
You are tuned in to Weekend Edition here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from ICTV. ICTV connects, informs, and empowers the community through diverse media. Learn more at watchictv.org. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kibbe, exploring the distinctly American art form. Hear more Jazz Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer-hosted Jazz on America Avenue. Native Defense presents the second annual Our Voices Restored community event Saturday, October 11th from 11 to 3 at the Beaux Arts Ballroom on the campus of Bemidji State University. There will be panel discussions, local music, a community meal, and resource table. Free and open to all. Trinity Lutheran Church on Highway 71 in Lake George has a lutefisk supper Saturday, October 11th from 4 to 7:30. They will also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. A federal judge in Oregon is blocking President Trump from deploying National Guard troops to Portland. U.S. District Judge Karen Emmergut issued a temporary order in a lawsuit brought by the city and the state. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says he was given an ultimatum about a National Guard deployment. The White House says President Trump has authorized 300 Guard troops to be sent to Chicago, where a woman was treated at a hospital and released after being shot by a Border Patrol agent yesterday amid protests against the immigration crackdown. In Game 2 of the best of seven WNBA finals is tonight. The Las Vegas Aces won Friday's opener against the Phoenix Mercury. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Mm-hmm.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Legacy Box, dedicated to helping customers turn boxes with family videos and photos into memories that can be shared with generations to come. More at legacybox.com. From Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for chefs and designed for restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Negotiations begin in Egypt tomorrow over President Trump's peace plan for Gaza. Hamas says it's willing to release all hostages. It's a pivotal moment in a war that's lasted nearly 2 years, but there's a lot left to negotiate. Let's talk about it with NPR's Daniel Estrin. He's in Tel Aviv. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Aisha.
So tell us about the negotiations. What details have been released so far?
Well, these are very high-level talks. They will involve top Israeli and Hamas officials. Also, U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff will be there and the President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as well. They're going to be meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, the Red Sea resort town in Egypt. Israel wants these negotiations to last only a few days, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that the U.S. Wants the same. And the idea being that they'll be discussing the technical details of the release of Israel's hostages that Hamas is holding in Gaza. 20 are believed to still be alive, about 28 are believed to be dead. And in exchange for them, Israel would release nearly 2,000 Palestinian detainees and prisoners. And Netanyahu said this weekend that he hoped that over the next week that he would be able to announce the return of the hostages all at once. But it is becoming very clear, Aisha, that this could take a lot longer.
Well, what are the main stumbling blocks that negotiators still need to address?
Well, Hamas officials say that some of the bodies of hostages are buried under rubble in Gaza, and so they're going to be needing more time to try to locate them and to recover their bodies. President Trump's plan that he outlined at the White House was that this would be done in 72 hours, that all of the hostages, living and dead, would be handed over within 72 hours, but that apparently is not feasible. We spoke to a person who was briefed by Egyptian officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to divulge the details and told us that the timetable will likely be extended on the hostage release to 7 days instead of 72 hours. And Egypt has prepared heavy machinery and cranes to remove rubble in agreed upon areas in Gaza to recover the Israeli hostage bodies. But there are many other issues to be raised in the talks. Hamas will likely be asking the Israeli military to halt their activity during the process of handing over the hostages, working those details out. Hamas will likely seek to negotiate on the Israeli withdrawal line. President Trump put out a map with a big yellow a line showing where Israeli troops are going to be withdrawing upon receipt of the hostages, but Hamas will likely seek to negotiate that. A lot is left to discuss. It's a very detailed plan that President Trump laid out for post-war Gaza. These upcoming talks are going to be focused on the first stages, and Hamas really wants one major thing, and that's a guarantee to prevent Israel from returning to war when the hostages are back.
What do people feel in Israel and Gaza? Are they hopeful at this time that these talks could really lead to the end of the war?
There really is optimism here, Aisha. There was a protest this weekend, a rally where Israelis gathered in Tel Aviv calling for the release of hostages. This is Karen Gill.
I crossed my fingers very hard, so it will finally happen because, you know, just when I'm thinking about it, it makes me like shiver because, you know, we want it so bad and let's hope it will happen.
In Gaza also, our reporter Anas Baba says that people are cautiously optimistic as well. President Trump asked Israel to stop bombing Gaza at this stage of negotiations, and yet Israel's bombardment does continue there. Gaza health officials say scores of Palestinians were killed just in the last day in Israeli strikes, and NPR's Anas Baba recorded this overnight.
Wow.
So you hear the sound of a warplane and an airstrike. An Israeli official told us that Israel is limiting its activity now in Gaza to defensive activities, not offensive. We don't know how exactly that is being defined, but there really is now hope in Gaza and in Israel that this could be the beginning of the end of the war.
That's NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
When you think of droughts, the first place that comes to mind probably isn't New England. But a dry summer has led to low water levels in large parts of Massachusetts. Most of the state is under significant drought conditions, and that means water restrictions and an increased risk of brush fires. To talk about this and when it may end, we turn to Ken Mahan. He's the lead meteorologist at the Boston Globe. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
How bad are these drought conditions throughout the state right now?
So the entire state as a whole is running what we call abnormally dry, which means that we've seen a prolonged period of precipitation reaching substantially below average. The Cape specifically are in a level of severe and moderate drought, and along Route 2 in northern Massachusetts is in a moderate drought as well, all stemming from the beginning of summer after a rather wet spring. But yes, this is becoming more common, and unfortunately, we've seen back-to-back and now back summers where we've seen less than average precipitation across the state.
Well, can I ask you, you said that it's becoming more common. We always have to ask, like, is this climate change?
Yeah, unfortunately, a big piece of it is climate change. When you do have a warming atmosphere and warming sea surface temperatures, then that is going to naturally change the way the atmosphere behaves. You think of the jet stream. The jet stream is the highway in which weather patterns traverse across the country. And over the last few summers, we've seen that jet stream become a little bit more to the north or diving down to the south of New England, which simply redirects storms away.
So what you're saying, just in layman's terms, is that the atmosphere conditions are changing, and so the jet streams are not bringing the storms and the water precipitation that they usually would to Massachusetts. They're sending them elsewhere?
That's absolutely correct. And also, with more heat in the atmosphere, it could hold more water vapor. And unfortunately, during the summer, when we need precipitation the most, the storms that do come through are much weaker.
So can you give us a sense of how unusual it is for it to be this dry right now?
Well, you think of Massachusetts. I was looking at the data. This summer alone, Massachusetts saw anywhere between 2 to 7 inches of rain deficit from June 1st. That has brought down 70% of stream flows and groundwater storages statewide. So that is a pretty significant drop. Northern New England as a whole, they saw the driest summer on record dating back nearly 130 years, with rainfall deficits over the summer reaching a foot, which is pretty astonishing.
When can the state expect some relief?
Looking at the long-term pattern, and I was just looking at the second half of fall and the beginning of winter, I do think that we will start to see some increased precipitation as far as events, not so much intensity. As I see the jet stream setup sort of continue, I think we're going to continue to see weaker storms heading into the new year. But hopefully we do end up getting a little bit more precipitation in the coming months.
Do you expect a warmer winter with less snow?
Unfortunately, I do. I just was diving into sort of the fleeting fall snow events across Boston and the state of Massachusetts, but we hardly see any snow during the fall season. And going into winter, yeah, I do unfortunately see a warmer than average winter once again, and then sort of a backloaded winter where snow doesn't really ramp up towards until the end of January and then tapers off pretty quickly at the beginning of March. It does look like we're in for another less than average snowfall season.
That's Kim Mahan, lead meteorologist at the Boston Globe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Aisha.
In many parts of Nigeria, funerals are often huge celebrations of life. but they can also involve some painful and unwelcome demands. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu experienced just that at the recent burial of his grandfather.
My grandpa, Augustine Bolaji Banjoko, was 91 when he passed away a few months ago at his home in the southwestern Nigerian city of Ibadan. He had 7 children and 16 grandchildren, and he died peacefully, surrounded by his family. He lived a full and long life, and in Yoruba tradition, we are to miss him but not mourn him. So his burial was a festival. And over 2 days, we danced and danced. A band of pallbearers were in full groove, twirling with the coffin hoisted on their shoulders. They led a large parade through the streets of his neighborhood, from the mortuary to his home, while a band with trumpets and talking drums played renditions of gospel songs and hymns. Later that evening, we held a service of songs under a canopy outside his home, full of moving tributes, including from his eldest child, my mom.
Baba mi, baba je onirele yo.
Then we partied late into the night again. But throughout the festivities, there was a slow drumbeat of greed and exploitation, intruding into the celebrations like uninvited guests. Funerals can bring out the best and the worst in people, which affected many of us, but particularly my mom, Antonia Banjoko Akinwotu.
My mind was all over the place already. I couldn't think. Wasn't nice at all.
It came to a head on the day of the burial, right at the entrance of my grandpa's village. A group of young men blocked the road. They'd heard about the funeral and they were waiting.
We got to the entrance, they blocked it. Number one, why are you blocking us from coming into this village?
We weren't allowed in unless we, quote, settled them first.
And they were like, oh yeah, we have to pay for the community. We haven't done anything to develop the community. For me to be paying you to bring my dad's body into the village he was born and bred.
Then another obstacle, this time from the church itself, where the ministers were waiting outside.
They pulled me and like, the envelopes that we prepared.
The church had told us we had to give each of their ministers a cash gift before the service could begin.
That what are we going to do for the church? Maybe we can do the sealing of the church because there is a leak. Or maybe we can buy you a motorcycle. Oh, you've seen the state of the church. Maybe there is something you can do to uplift it.
But what followed was even more painful. As the final hymns and rites began, and the coffin about to be lowered into the grave, a representative for the village chief suddenly pulled my mom aside. He said we had to see the chief before the burial continued, to pay respect and to pay him his dues too.
I came to bury my dad. I had to try and blank my mind because at that point, I could snap. I lost that moment where I needed to say my final goodbye to my dad.
What we went through is far from rare in Nigeria, where funerals can be seen by some groups as opportunities for profit. This dynamic becomes even more intense when families from the city make rare returns to their villages. My grandpa's funeral ended on a high. We held the reception in a large hall draped in white and gold. The party was overflowing with food and drinks, and like many Nigerian celebrations, it featured an impressive range of souvenirs, mugs, notebooks, towels, Tupperware, printed with my grandpa's image and messages like, celebration of an icon. The highs and lows of the funeral were tough, but a guiding light was that we were honoring his final wishes. He wanted to be buried wearing the traditional clothes he wore when he married my grandma.
That was 60 years ago. It's not good anymore, but he still dry cleaned it.
And he wanted to be buried in his village and laid to rest beside his mom. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Ibadan.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. If you've ever rescued a lamp or end table from the curb, you've lived the mantra, reuse and repair, rather than let perfectly good stuff head to the landfill. In Portland, Oregon, that extends to snacks and apps. Crystal Liguori reports on a nonprofit there that's keeping food from getting tossed and using it to feed people.
It's a Saturday morning in the community room of the Rockwood Station Apartments, and Tania Torkelson is busy.
And then you start with the produce area and work your way around.
Torkelson is a volunteer helping run the Urban Gleaners Free Food Market happening here.
There wasn't that many people that used to come here. When I first started, there was like 10 or 15 people most. But like the past few months, it's been double.
There's mothers with kids in tow, elderly folks with walkers, and 20-somethings like Malachi Gillis.
I feel like there is a lot of hesitancy starting to go to food pantries when getting stuff, but it's like everybody's here for a reason. It's because everybody needs food.
And the 550 pounds of food at this market would have been thrown away had it not been rescued by Urban Gleaners.
I got bagels. There's a ham and Swiss sandwich. We got a lot of poke.
There's also organic milk, overnight oats, a plethora of fresh produce, and even baked goods. For nearly two decades, the Portland nonprofit has collected fresh food destined for the dump and redistributed it through markets just like this. There are 42 each week in the Portland metro area.
Each month, we see anywhere between 80,000 to 105,000 pounds of food come into the space. Our main partners are some of the big grocery stores in the area, Trader Joe's, Zupan's, New Seasons, Whole Foods.
That's Haris Kuljancic, the executive director of Urban Gleaners. He has a personal connection to this work.
I originally came from Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I was born in the middle of a war, and my family came to the U.S. as refugees. Almost immediately, we very much benefited from food access organizations, food banks.
The food is more than just grocery store stock. There's also fruits and vegetables from local farms, and prepared food from catering companies, restaurants, and even the corporate kitchens at Nike and Intel. But if this food is good, why is it being thrown away? Zia LaBeouf is a community support associate at Urban Gleaners. She answers that question in the back warehouse of a local grocery store where shelves and fridges are overflowing with food.
Here's a pack of what I'm assuming was four yogurts. One of them probably broke off, so the date of expiration is like a month out. But because one of them broke off, they can't sell it. Perfect example of where we can come in.
There's fresh baked bread that hadn't sold the day before, and also bunches of rainbow carrots, organic apples, and a large box of grapes that look totally fine. LaBeouf says with produce, there's often overstock stores need to get rid of. With farms, they may have extra produce at the end of the season and can't afford the labor to pick it. So Urban Gleaners comes with volunteers. And then there are some things that are near or past their sell-by date, which means they're past peak freshness, but doesn't mean they've gone bad.
I'm also like kind of squeezing containers because that's a really easy way to check for carbonation, which means it's kind of in its process of not being as fresh as it once was.
They check all the food like this to make sure it's still good. In addition to their markets, Urban Gleaners is trying to erase the stigma around gleaned foods in other ways. Last month, they held an annual summer supper, inviting chefs from around Oregon to showcase their skills using mostly gleaned ingredients. For NPR News, I'm Crystal Liguori in Portland.
This is NPR News.
You are listening to Weekend Edition here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from the Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. WatermarkArtsCenter.org. KXE KBXE Book Club is reading How to Solve Your Own Murder by Kristen Perrin for October. Meetings are at 5:30 Wednesday, October 8th at KAXE in Grand Rapids and Tuesday, October 21st at KBXE in Bemidji. The City of Cohasset Parks and Rec Department offers Woodsy Walks at Tioga every Monday and Thursday at 1:30 p.m. Free and open to all. Meet at the Tioga Recreation Area parking lot. Camp Confidence near Brainerd hosts Community Day today from noon to 5 with activities like pumpkin painting, a scavenger hunt, and more.
I'm Joel Snyder with these headlines. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he hopes he will soon be able to announce the release of the remaining hostages being held in Gaza. Netanyahu spoke late Saturday as Israel and Hamas prepare for indirect talks in Egypt on President Trump's plan to end the war. Israeli military strikes continue to hit Gaza despite a call from Trump for Israel to stop the bombing. Poland says it scrambled warplanes early today to protect its airspace after Russia launched another round of airstrikes on Ukraine. All of Ukraine was under air raid alerts for several hours last night. And a tropical storm watch is up for parts of Mexico's southwestern coast. Forecasters expect tropical storm Priscilla to strengthen into a hurricane by early tomorrow. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Luminescence Foundation. Luminescence Foundation is dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us, as always, is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition. How's it going, Will?
Excellent. How are you, Aisha?
I'm good. Now, Will, please remind us of last week's challenge.
Yes, it came from Andrea Carla Michaels of San Francisco. I said, name a famous actress, five-letter first name, six-letter last. Change the first and third letters of the first name and the first letter of her last name, and the resulting string of letters in order from left to right will name a place where you might see this actress. Well, the actress is Jodie Foster. Change the J, D, and F, you get movie poster, which is where you might see her picture.
Okay, well, there were more than 650 correct entries this week. I mean, it was a bit of a toughie. And this week's winner is Aaron Rohde of Plymouth, Minnesota. Congratulations, Aaron.
Thank you.
So how did you figure out this week's answer?
You know, I couldn't get screen to be an actress, but movie, I pretty quickly got to Jodie, and then Jodie Foster, and then movie poster.
Oh, okay. So you kind of work backwards.
Yes,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense. So how long have you been playing the puzzle?
The first one I remember getting was 2006. So at least that long.
But this is your first time coming on to play the puzzle.
Exactly. Yes.
So my understanding is you've been on Jeopardy?
I was on Jeopardy in 2015, I think.
Okay. Okay.
Well, we have to ask how you did.
I had fun. That's my line.
Okay.
Don't ask me about Kafka's The Metamorphosis. It's a touchy subject.
I mean, I gotta ask you, but it seems pretty clear. I mean, Aaron, are you ready to play the puzzle?
I'm definitely ready to play the puzzle.
All right, take it away, Will.
All right, Aaron and Aisha, I'm going to give you the first word of a familiar two-word phrase. You tell me the second word in the phrase. And here's a hint. The first two letters of my word are the last two letters of yours. For example, if I said electric, you would say eel, because electric starts E-L and eel ends E-L.
Got it.
All right, and your first one is unearned.
Unearned? Unearned run.
You got it. Okay, next ones are four-letter answers. Ski, S-K-I.
Ski.
Something you would wear.
Ski mask.
That's it. Peace, P-E-A-C-E.
Peace pipe.
You got it. Stress.
Stress test.
That's it. One, O-N-E.
One.
Think golf for this one.
Think golf. One iron.
That's it. Second.
Second base.
You got it. Now we're going for five-letter answers. Centrifugal.
Centrifugal force.
You got it. Chess.
Chess match.
That's it. Organ.
Organ donor.
Uh-huh. Antarctic
Ocean.
That's it. Now we go for six letters. Shoe, S-H-O-E.
Shoe polish.
That's it. Old, O-L-D.
Old school?
That's it. Good. Red, R-E-D.
Red square?
You have it. Saint, S-A-I-N-T.
Saint.
Oh. It's a famous one.
Saint Teresa?
That's right. Now the last two are longer than six letters. General. Something that Jeopardy will test.
Knowledge. General knowledge.
That's right. And your last one is deadly.
Deadly.
It's a plant.
Plant. Deadly.
A plant you don't want to eat.
All I have is deadly parasite, which is not actually the word. Plant you don't want to eat.
What if I tell you it starts with N?
Think of like, it's not day, but it's
nightshade. Deadly nightshade.
Nightshade.
I'm allergic to tomatoes. I should have gotten that right away.
Aaron, you are so fast.
I mean, you knocked it out the park. So for playing our puzzle today, you get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And Aaron, what member station do you listen to?
I listen to KNOW out of St. Paul, Minnesota.
That's Aaron Rohde of Plymouth, Minnesota. Thanks for playing the puzzle.
Thank you.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from Mike Reese, who's a showrunner, writer, and producer for The Simpsons. Think of a famous singer. Replace the last three letters of the first name with an E. Also replace the last three letters of the last name with an E. And the result will be a world-famous location. What singer is this? So again, a famous singer. Replace the last three letters of the first name and the last name, each with the letter E. And the result will be a world-famous location. What singer is this?
You have your assignment, puzzlers. When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, to submit your response. Just fill out the form on the puzzle page. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, October 9th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call. And if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Aisha.
Sometimes all it takes to get past insecurities is connecting to who you really are. Other times, it's a primal scream from your core. British rock band Wolf Alice explores those two things in their new song, Bloom Baby Bloom. We spoke to singer Ellie Rausel and drummer Joel Amy about their approach to music.
My name's Ellie. I sing and play guitar in Wolf Alice. You know, we all face challenges no matter how big or how small, and I've often turned to music in my times of need. Whether it's like to channel into an emotion or a feeling that just makes me feel better, or if I'm really listening to lyrics to feel seen, like both those ways of listening to music have served me well. I think it's like saying that it's not easy to flourish, but it's possible.
My name's Joel and I play the drums. When I'm playing this song, I'm just trying to channel that Muppet that plays the drums, you know, Animal. Yeah, just on the floor tom for like 3.5 minutes. So maybe I'm trying to outgrow my non-animal persona and into my animal persona. It's primal and it's like a caveman drum beat, do you know what I mean? And I like it for that. That's what the drums were, its role were in that song, was just to be the heartbeat, you know?
Yeah.
a primal scream to remind yourself that you are brilliant as you are and not to let anyone let you forget that. Maybe when you feel a doubt of your own strength and power, like it could serve as a kind of encouragement or something that you are amazing.
That was Ellie Rousel and Joel Amey of the band Woof Alice. Their song Bloom Baby Bloom is out now on their latest album, The Clearing. They call her the mother of Colombian corals. At 70, marine biologist Elvira Alvarado is still diving, researching, and training a new generation of scientists. Her mission, rescuing Colombia's endangered coral reefs and improving ways to get coral to reproduce. As John Otis reports, it's been her life's work.
Can you imagine paradise? It's paradise.
That's Elvira Alvarado recalling her first time exploring a coral reef.
Everything was alive, and it was green and bright orange, and there were fishes, and there were huge things, and they were corals.
That was nearly 50 years ago, but Alvarado still gets a thrill researching these marine invertebrates that are related to jellyfish. We meet up on the Colombian island of San Andres in the Caribbean Sea, where she's leading a project to reproduce coral. They provide food, shelter, and breeding grounds for 4,000 fish species. Coral protects shorelines from erosion. They also support tourism by attracting snorkelers and divers. However, diseases, pollution, and rising ocean temperatures are taking a huge toll, says Juliana Vanegas, a marine biologist who works with Alvarado.
The corals are still alive, but they're bleached and they are not feeding, and they start to get like weak and weak and weak. Mm-hmm. And if that lasts for enough time, the corals die, basically of starvation.
Since the 1970s, when Alvarado first put on a wetsuit, more than half of all the coral in the Caribbean have died. Here on San Andres, she says 70% are gone.
I saw them dying. I saw them turning white. I saw them getting loose. And that was the moment I said, this is what
I want to do?
Yes.
Television also drew her to the ocean. As a young girl living in the U.S., she was fascinated by programs like Sea Hunt and Flipper, about a bottlenose dolphin that outsmarted most of the humans on the show. She moved back to Colombia in the 1960s to become one of the country's first female marine biologists to focus on coral reef restoration. Along the way, she got to meet the world's most famous oceanographer when he came through Colombia.
Jacques Cousteau, of course. You know, I knew him in person.
Wow.
You can't imagine what a young girl, marine biologist, having him by your side. We sat down and he was talking to me. It was a dream.
Alvarado was a natural underwater. She learned to free dive without air tanks to a depth of 72 feet. She also excelled in the lab. She initially did cancer research involving sharks. However, as coral began dying off, she focused on reef restoration by growing new coral. Coral that's been weakened by disease or overheated water have a much harder time reproducing. So here on San Andres, Alvarado and her team, decked out in scuba gear, are lending a hand through in vitro fertilization. Timing is everything. Corals spawn just once a year, about a week after the full moon. That gives Alvarado's team a tiny window of opportunity to dive down and collect coral eggs and sperm. I tag along to see how it's done. Alvarado moves gracefully underwater. Some 30 feet down, she and her team place nets with collection tubes around selected coral. Then they return to shore and wait for them to spawn.
Successful dive?
Yes, it was. We found every colony, and we put the 15 traps on them. So it was good.
Hours later, on a second dive, they check the collection tubes. Last night, they came up empty. But tonight's a different story. The coral have spawned. The divers have come back with eggs and sperm, and they're ecstatic. Next, they head to a makeshift laboratory to fertilize them. They mix together eggs and sperm and place them in water-filled plastic tubs. Later, Alvarado shows us what the tiny coral embryos look like.
So I'm looking through a microscope at recently fertilized coral eggs, and they kind of have the shape of little raspberries.
Soon, the coral hatchlings will be placed in seaside nurseries for 6 to 12 months. Then, the young coral will be transplanted to existing reefs. And because the team has gathered genetic material from coral that appear more resistant to heat and stress, such coral IVF is designed to reproduce hardier varieties. The trick, says Alvarado, is to regenerate coral faster than and they die. But she's also realistic.
We are not going to have the same.
You're never going to see coral reefs like what you first saw when you first got in the water and started scuba diving.
Not with diversity, but we will have a reef that is resistant to the warming conditions.
She's also proud to have motivated young marine biologists, mostly women, who all seem to adore her. They include Maria Fernanda Maya, who heads the Blue Indigo Foundation that works to restore reefs.
She's a very inspiring woman. She's my teacher. She's my professor. I'm learning from her. She's the mother of corals in Colombia.
That's why when Alvarado finally does hang up her swim fins, her legacy will live on.
When I started this, we were three, two students and me. And look what we've got now.
Now it's big.
It's big. We have three sites. A lot of people. This thing will continue even after I'm dead. This will continue. That's a good thing.
For NPR News, I'm John Otis on San Andres Island, Colombia.
This is Week in Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Lakeland PBS, offering 24/7 PBS Kids programming, the PBS Kids video app, educational resources for teachers, parents, and more at lptv.org. Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Lunch series tomorrow at noon. Minnesota author Stephanie Marocha will discuss her new book, Tree Trek. You may bring your own lunch. The Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork hosts an opening reception from 5 to 7 on Thursday, October 9th for a new exhibit of paintings and murals called Anima Mundi. Meet the artist, and you can stay for the classic movie series at 6:30. This month's film is Night of the Living Dead from 1968. Pine River Market Square will hold an indoor growers and crafters market Saturday, October 11th from 10 to 2 at the Warehouse on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Local band Every Bird will provide live music.